time for reflection and do I want to be in this industry? Do I want to do this? And realizing all the wonderful things about veterinary medicine and what it had brought to me and given to me, and all of the reasons that it was worth staying in and that I just needed to do it different. One of the things I say as a consultant is that instead of the business running you, let me help you run the business. And it was that same feeling at that time of, you know, this industry isn't in charge of me. I'm in charge of me. So I can do this any way I want. I can go work for somebody. I can go work for myself. I can create the seminar. I can send out flyers. I can do all these things and just, it will go where it's supposed to go. But I always can be in charge of it. And so realizing that and then sticking to that, and having that motivation to drive it. I got up every day during those 6 weeks like I was going to work. I got dressed like I was going to work. The TV didn't come on. The computer came up and the notes started and creating and developing these things. And okay, if I'm going to be a consultant, what are things people want to talk about? What are the questions I need to ask? When I go in, where do we start? How do we work through these things? And you know, you end up with a package and a plan, and then you just need somebody that lets you execute it with them. And, and that came together. So a lot of self-reflection, a lot of what ifs and whys, but not staying down in the trenches too long. I'm a big country music fan. I love Reba McEntire and Dolly Parton especially. And Dolly Parton has the famous saying that if you want to have the rainbow, you've got to have the rain. Mm-hmm. And So, that's what I did. You got to have some rain.
You got to have some rain. I agree with you. And Dolly, I love Dolly.
Hello, my name is Debbie Boone, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Bend, where we explore how successful people, some well-known and others not as much, navigated the path and emerged in a better place when life threw them a curve. It's inspired by one of my favorite sayings, the bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the curve. These conversations will hopefully help you and inspire you to embrace your personal bend and flourish. I hope you enjoy The Bend and add it to your subscriptions. And if you need help with your own personal navigation and are in veterinary medicine, please feel free to reach out to me at Debbie Boone to Manage Vets Consulting. Now enjoy The Bend and be inspired by our amazing guest. Welcome.
So hello, everyone, and welcome back to The Bend. My name is Debbie Boone, and I am your host for this episode. I am a practice management consultant based in South Carolina, but I used to travel all over the United States. And I want to introduce you to my friend, Marshall Liger, because Marshall and I, we go back a while. We're both CVPMs, and we have a kind of a similar career path, kind of started at the bottom rung and worked our way up into practices. So Marshall actually became fascinated with parrots around the age of 13. And then he kept working with rare and endangered parrots. And we have a little treat for you because he's going to show us one of his parrots as we end up this interview. He also began working in a veterinary clinic at the age of 17. And then he became a licensed veterinary technician, got his certified veterinary practice management, and then SHRM-CP, which means he's a human resources professional. He also has a bachelor's in business. So he's worked in every role in the hospital that he legally can. So no surgery for Marshall, but everything else. Okay. He now works as the hospital administrator for a multi-location veterinary operation, but he also works independently as a practice management consultant. He started his own conference, the Palmetto Veterinary Management Seminar, and I was supposed to speak at it this past year, and COVID got us all, so I'm hoping that he is going to have that rise up again after the pandemic is over and we get to do it again, because it's in Charleston, South Carolina, and one of my favorite places. And there was going to be so many amazing people at that conference. So I was disappointed. But Marshall was South Carolina's LVT of the year in 2009. And he currently serves on the South Carolina Board of Veterinary Medical Examiners. So there's not too many non-veterinarians that serve in board positions. So I want to explore that a little bit. So Marshall, thanks for coming on and squeezing me in today in your very busy schedule.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate you inviting me. I'm excited and looking forward to it. I was running around getting ready for this because I don't want to mess up on Debbie Boone's show and I'm vacuuming. I'm like, wait a minute, this is Zoom. I don't have to do all that.
You don't have to worry about vacuuming on Zoom.
No. I make sure the camera doesn't show that.
I was speaking at a conference. It was one of the very first online conferences, and Becky Moser was one of the people who was putting it on. And I was at the beach with friends. And so I was out on the beach in my bathing suit, and I had to come in to give the conference. So I threw a suit jacket on top of the bathing suit, and I gave a conference lecture in a bathing suit. Now, it was, you know, you couldn't tell, but that's all right. But I showed it to Becky when I was stood up and showed it to Becky, and she just died laughing. She said, this is great. This is great. But nobody could tell. So anyway, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, kind of how you got where you are. And really, your original goal in life, was it to work in veterinary medicine? Or I know the parents got you kind of hooked into some avian medicine, but was that what your intention was?
You know, I just remember that as a kid, my mom and I both were always intrigued with animals, and there were always many of them around. And that's the cliche thing that all of us say, right, is I love animals. So, you know, we hear that in every interview. But as a kid, it started that way. And then my mom and I got into the parrots in my early teens, about 13. And yeah, just grew from there. And so I knew that I was probably either looking down a path with animals or a completely other idea. I was always infatuated with law and thought it would be amazing to be a family court judge. I don't know why I pulled up that, but that was the only thing I wanted to do. If I was going the law path, that would have been the goal. But I stuck to this side of things, and it's been very nice.
I can't imagine listening to divorce cases and child custody cases all day long and thinking how depressing that might be. So I think you chose a wise path in going into veterinary medicine. So when you decided to work in a veterinary hospital, I mean, you said you were 17 when you walked in the door. Was that because you had birds and you were, you know, bringing your birds to that practice and you got the job? Or was this a just completely random job that you thought you'd give it a shot?
I got the job because my mom's coworker's college age child was working at this clinic and leaving. And so we found out about it, and the exiting person kind of put me in, and they took me, and then it just went from there.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, it kind of happened.
Yeah. You know, there's so many stories of how kids started that young working in veterinary hospitals and then moved on to become licensed techs or managers or veterinarians. I know that as a manager, I hired so many young people in the summertime, particularly for those extra jobs. The boarding kennel would fill up and get crazy, and we would have those. So tell me about the career path. So you got into veterinary medicine, you were working as an assistant. What made you decide to pursue your LVT?
Well, through those years in the clinic, and I was in college and would work at the clinic as well. And, you know, am I going to vet school or what am I going to do with this undergrad degree? What kind of undergrad degree do I want? My work with the parrots was just growing exponentially. I was doing all kinds of events, local meetings and bird shows and speaking at conferences and raising endangered species. And just so I didn't want to give all of that up and move away for vet school. Mm-hmm. I didn't really like the idea of just 4 years as a student in vet school. But I've always had a personality to, I hate to say be in charge, but to kind of, you know, to do things, to figure things out, to push it along, get it done. And so the operations just made more sense for me and developed over that time. So I thought, well, this veterinary technology program is new in town. I'll do that. And it just kept going from there.
Mm-hmm. And now, how long were you a tech before you moved up into management?
About 13 years total. My tech degree came maybe about 8 or 9 years into that.
You know, I know that it's a very common story that you have somebody in your practice that's just a really great tech, and then you say, hey, I'll just let you manage the practice. But it's a different skill set. And tell me about that transition, because, you know, this is a story about curveballs. And I would love to know how you made that bend in the road, going from licensed technician and doing tech work every day to saying, okay, now you're going to run the practice.
Yeah. Well, I spent 13 years at the first practice. They were like family, just wonderful to me. And I did some leadership things there and, you know, was involved with various aspects, but I wasn't the manager. Went out on a boat ride with a friend one weekend. He says, hey, my friend's taking us out on the boat. You want to go with me? Well, it ended up being another local veterinarian's boat. She had a practice she was just recently starting. And she said, I need somebody to help me run this thing. And I think that's you. And I ended up there and it just started from there. So I went into that job suddenly with this title and I'm like, okay. I thought 13 years in the business, I knew what I was doing. And I got there and I was like, I don't know anything. but I loved that challenge and took that and ran with it and learned a lot there. And that was when I earned my CVPM while I was working there. And I was able to work with the accountant and all the different people that are involved, the industry representatives, et cetera. So it really started there.
Now, you know, I think that taking that leap is kind of a scary event. So what was the scariest part of that challenge for you that said, you know, I don't really know how to manage a practice, but I'm going to go for it? Because so many times people have opportunities and they let fear or their I'm not good enough or that self-talk that says I don't know how to do this perfectly stop them from achieving some goals. So tell me how you know, kind of talked to yourself and said, I'm going to go for it.
Well, it was scary. You're right. 13 years at one place. And that practice owner was like a father figure for me. So the decision to leave there was, you know, an emotional one as well. But it just made sense as I thought about it. And I took my time and the place I was going, she had to be patient with me. And I had lots of questions and what ifs and how's this and a few vendor representatives that I was close with, networked with them and learned a little bit. So I took my time and just explored it. And then, you know, sick to my stomach, pulled the trigger and like, I have to do this. So I'll hold my breath and jump off the cliff.
That's it. Sometimes you just have to jump in the deep end and realize you're going to make mistakes. Nobody's perfect as they go into these hospitals. And I think sometimes you and I are consultants and people tend to think of us as the people who just know everything and have never made mistakes and just know how to do all this stuff right. But, you know, I think my biggest learning experiences were the things I screwed up and the things you don't know until you get into it. You go, oh man, I really shouldn't have done that or hired that person or said that thing or had that comment to the client. So obviously you were very deliberate in your decision-making, but again, willing to take the leap. And I like the fact that you said you talked to your network, because I'm a huge believer in network and asking other people's opinions, and especially your sales reps, because they go in a lot of hospitals and they probably have a really great perspective as to who you wanted to avoid and who would be a great place to work. And I think that's something that maybe people looking to make changes don't take that opportunity to talk to those people who have a lot of experience out there going in and out of hospitals, you know, maybe 50 to 75, maybe up to 100, depending on how many hospitals they rep. How did you determine that? I mean, when you did you have reps you were close to that you just felt really comfortable reaching out to?
I did, yes. There were several that I knew and that had been with calling on us for several years, and you get to know them and learn little things about each other. And Charleston's a very friendly city here anyway, so we're all the community is only so big, and you just get to know each other. And you know, one of the things I see on forums all the time, you and I are in some of these same forums, is comments about not wanting reps to come by, or they only see them by appointment, or things like that. And I always just want to reach through the computer and be like, but these people are so wonderful and so important and so helpful and valuable. And they have a really important role in our practices too. And stop that.
Stop that. That's right. Yeah, I actually wrote a blog about using your network, and the reps are part of your network. They want you to succeed, because when you succeed, they succeed. And they have a broad vision of the community of veterinary medicine, because they're in so many diverse practices. And I can remember when I first started consulting, and you probably had this experience too. If you grow up in practices like we did, and you think, oh, this is normal. This is what practices run like. This is the medicine that they have. This is the culture that they build. Maybe not everybody practices as quality of medicine, because I grew up in AHA accredited hospitals. I'm kind of a medicine snob. And then you get out into the world and you're like, whoa, this is not a well-run business. I've been in practices who don't even know their financial numbers until the end of the year, when the accountant hands them their tax returns. And by then it's too late to fix anything. You know, you've already screwed it up, and you can't go back a year and fix it, instead of looking at their P&Ls more frequently. So when you started doing consulting, and I do want to ask you, like, how did you transition from, you know, just managing hospitals to, and obviously getting your CVPM, but then moving forward out of that into starting to consult and actually creating your own conference? Because that's, to me, that's a very intimidating thing to do. I want to do it. I've always wanted to have a communication-based conference that would be, all the speakers would be about communication. And so how did you go from there to consulting and the conference building?
Yeah. Sometimes I think I don't know. It just, that second job, when I was the practice manager I spoke of, I was there for 5 years. Again, small practice, you know how it is. The practice manager and the practice owner work very close together. They work in tandem. The manager ends up almost kind of being like a not owner, co-owner feeling relationship. And that was true. And then it ended tumultuously, and that was a big wound. I was ready to leave veterinary medicine at that point. I was in that self-talk of, oh, woe is me, I can't believe this, blah, blah, blah. But then I took some time, just really thought it through and did what I always do, which is grab the bull by the horns and realize that nothing's going to change unless I change it. And I happen to be good at that. So here we go. And I just pulled out my notepads and started making notes and started creating lists and outlines. And next thing I knew, I was doing this work and saying, you know, if I'm going to stay in this field, I don't want to work in just one place. I want to get out there and help others, because I know what I've experienced. I know what my woes have been. I see what other people are experiencing, the same challenges in the forums. I'd like to get more involved, and I'd like to do more than just this job description. And so I said, well, I'm going to call myself a practice management consultant, and a few people were dumb enough to believe me, and it just rolled from there. And I was like, oh, well, I think I need a logo. Well, I think I need a URL. Well, I think I need this. And it just kept going. And so I've always remained fully employed as hospital administrator. Had a large six doctor, 40 employee practice. Now I have the two locations that I'm hospital administrator of, but still do my freelance consulting on the side. The seminar, the Palmetto Veterinary Management Seminar, came, a drug rep called and said, I have a clinic that's interested in some management CE, but they don't want to pay the price to go to a big conference out of state. Is there anything you know of within driving distance? And classic Marshall, I said, no, but I'll make something. And next thing I knew, I was putting together this event. And again, people were crazy enough to believe in me, and it worked, and people showed up, and there were 25 people there. And I'm just looking around the room like, wow, okay, we're onto something. People want this. And it just went from there, and it grew. And before COVID, as you mentioned, you were going to be on the list of speakers, and everybody was excited to hear from you. About 100 people were signed up. I don't remember now, like 6 or 8 states represented of people coming in for it. So it just was a need. It just, yeah. It was an accident. And then people said, wait, we need that.
Yeah. Well, it didn't help that you live in Charleston. I mean, that didn't hurt. That's a great location too. You know, I live in Myrtle Beach, so either way, we're probably going to attract some people if we decide to do some conferences. The bumps in the road are some of the things that I'm interested in talking to you about, because the story of the bend really has to do with how we overcome some of these unexpected things that life throws at us. And I know you said that you and your practice owner ended that relationship kind of in a tumultuous manner. And I know that I certainly was blindsided in 2008 when my practice owner said, I can't afford to have you anymore. And then you're stuck in the middle of the recession. And so then I started, like you said, you just do it. You just start your business. And I reached out to all those sales reps that I was friends with and said, you know, hey, I'm going to do this, this, and this. They go, yeah, we're going to put you to work, because they're the ones who saw what you could do. They were that outside observer that knew that you knew your stuff. And so I don't think I ever not had some work to do, like from the time I started it, because of the relationships that I had built with them. So tell me, you know, the bumps in the road when you were building your business, or when you were separated from this job, and then moved into the next thing. What did you encounter? What it challenges? I mean, or did it go smoothly for you?
It didn't go all that smoothly. Maybe some. I knew that show was over, and so I was preparing, which was great. So that when it was over, I kind of had a head start. But there was still, I think, about 6 weeks in between before I started my next job. And like I said, I used that time for reflection and, do I want to be in this industry? Do I want to do this? And realizing all the wonderful things about veterinary medicine and what it had brought to me and given to me, and all of the reasons that it was worth staying in and that I just needed to do it different. Mm-hmm. One of the things I say as a consultant is that instead of the business running you, let me help you run the business. And it was that same feeling at that time of, you know, this industry isn't in charge of me. I'm in charge of me. So I can do this any way I want. I can go work for somebody. I can go work for myself. I can create the seminar. I can send out flyers. I can do all these things, and just, it will go where it's supposed to go. But I always can be in charge of it. Mm-hmm. And so realizing that and then sticking to that And having that motivation to drive it, I got up every day during those 6 weeks like I was going to work. I got dressed like I was going to work. The TV didn't come on. The computer came up and the notes started and creating and developing these things. And okay, if I'm going to be a consultant, what are things people want to talk about? What are the questions I need to ask? When I go in, where do we start? How do we work through these things? And you know, you end up with a package and a plan, and then you just need somebody that lets you execute it with them. And, and that came together. So a lot of self-reflection, a lot of what ifs and whys, but not staying down in the trenches too long. I'm a big country music fan. I love Reba McEntire and Dolly Parton especially. And Dolly Parton has the famous saying that if you want to have the rainbow, you've got to have the rain. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I did. You got to have some rain.
Yeah, have some rain. I agree with you. And Dolly. I love Dolly. Yeah. One of the things that struck me when you were talking about that was the fact that you said, even though you didn't have a formal job, you got up every morning like you had a job and you worked on this plan. So to me, I think one of the most challenging parts of being a consultant in running your own business or doing anything that you don't have a supervisor over you is the self-discipline that says, this is the work I have to do. And it would be so easy to not do any of those things, just to put it off and procrastinate and say, oh, well, you know, I'll get to it tomorrow. So what advice would you give to people who are struggling with, maybe they did lose their job, or maybe they're making a decision about whether to stay in their profession or not, not even necessarily vet med, but about the discipline that it takes to get up and start to create something?
Well, I think part of it is to give yourself permission to feel it and experience it and go through it. You can't block it out. You can't run from it. You've got to let it be. But again, you can be in charge of it. So whether that's grief or sadness, or in my case, doubt of should I stay here, here meaning the profession, I think you have to allow yourself to experience that so that you can work through those feelings and find, you know, the other side of it, which was all of the good, wonderful things I found. So you have to allow yourself, give yourself that permission. And then, yeah, the self-discipline part that comes with it of just realizing that, okay, I can't just lay here. Potato chips aren't helpful. but a sprint around the block is. So let's go and just move that oxygen, you know? Mm-hmm. And those were all things that I did too. And
yeah, I agree with you. I mean, because when it's kind of a punch to your ego to think that you're dispensable and that something particularly that you've worked very hard for all of a sudden says, you know, we're gonna do this without you. And then you think, okay, well, maybe I'm not as good at this as I thought I was. And you start to think about those things, but then you think, no, I really am as good at this as I think I am. Yeah. And that my self-worth is not tied to what other people think. It, you know, in looking at the majority of people out there in the world that support you and think that you do good work. And I think we both have those people out there who are cheerleading for us, which is wonderful. Then you take those people and you listen to those people and you go, okay. But I do think you have to listen some to people who give you negative feedback too. And I can remember, I've given so many talks and lectures, and you know, teaching the Patterson University classes, and I was talking about spay-neuter clinics and maybe kind of stick-em-and-go medicine. And I've already confessed to my snobbery about, you know, quality medicine. And I made some kind of remark I probably shouldn't have. And I got some feedback on a survey that says, you know, I felt like you discounted what I do. We work really hard to do what we do and serve our clients. And I thought, you know, that's right. I really should not be putting down other practices. There's places for every kind of practice. And so I took that negative feedback and I changed my approach to that. And then I did start to confess the fact that I am a snob about meditation, but that not everybody is, and that there is a place for all different kinds of practices in the world, because not every client wants the level of care that I demand for my pets and that I want to work in. So we do learn from some negative feedback. So have you had a lesson, Marshall, like that one, that you got some feedback that you go, oh, you know, I need to pay attention to that?
Yeah, sure. Now I'm trying to think of an example because I know you want one, but yeah, absolutely. Those things happen. And, you know, I'll ask for them, even if I'm sitting with my boss or, you know, friends and colleagues, whoever. I'll be like, okay, what did you think of this? What, tell me what it was like on your side when I just gave that presentation, or we're preparing to do reviews of our team, but give me one too. I want some feedback as well. You know, what can I be doing differently? So yeah, I mean, I ask for it and look for it, and it's important to hear it. You always feel a little defensive at first, but I think that's normal. But then you take that part out and you look for what's useful and leave the rest behind.
Right, exactly. You know, you're not going to please 100% of the people. And again, going back to, I kind of calculated that I taught more than 10,000 students in groups of 30 a piece. And most of the time there's good feedback and people enjoy the class and they feel like they got a lot out of it. And then every now and then there's the one. And Debbie Hill and I have talked about this. We're like, were you in the same room with all these other 30 people? Because we really think you were in a different building. But it has a lot to do with the willingness of that person to be receptive to what you're teaching. And maybe they aren't mentally ready to hear what you have to say because maybe it makes them really uncomfortable. Maybe you strike it a little too close to home for them with whatever you're talking about. And so I think that's an important perspective to have. You know, if several people give you the feedback, or it's a legitimate piece of feedback, they go, oh yeah, I really did mess that up. I need to do that better. But if it is something that you feel like they were forced to be there, you can always tell that somebody, their boss has made them go to class for you to fix them, right? And they're not going to be fixed because they have a negative attitude from the time they walked in the door, this barrier that they put up, like, I'm not going to learn anything because I'm stuck here in this thing for a day. But if you have to also be able to keep your purpose in mind and keep moving forward, because if you believe your message, then you're on a mission to help. And it's like you said, I can help more practices than just one. If I'm out in the world and I'm teaching these things and I'm making conferences like you do and helping a lot of people succeed in this profession. So we talked a little bit about networking, but what was the value of networking in helping you accomplish, you know, becoming a consultant or even getting this next job as the administrator of a multi-practice and putting your conference together?
Oh, I mean, networking is just everything. The value is invaluable. It's just infinite. It's not what you have, it's who you know. And I've heard that and I really believe that it's true. And when, you know, your network supports you and wants to believe in you and take care of you, and you're believing in them and taking care of them. And it's just a circle, and it just takes care of everybody, and that it's invaluable what comes from it, and you can't predict it. It just happens.
You're right. It is so unpredictable because, and I love the thing that you said, because I've talked to several people about this and just got through interviewing Doug Brooks. And he said, you network with people not to gain, but to give. And if there's something that I can do that helps you, I freely will do that. But then, and I don't expect anything in return, but sometimes it does return. and in an unexpected way through two or three layers of you. It's not even you. It might be four people down from what somebody you know that is listening to what you say and go, oh, you need to go and talk to her.
Yeah. It's so true. And that was one of the great things that I realized about my seminar was the camaraderie that started to come from it and bringing people together into that room for the day. And the fun that they would have on breaks and lunch and moving around. And so I would do things like, you know, added a big red carpet for photo sessions with all these props, you know, feather boas and stuff. And just watching people that didn't even know each other end up on the red carpet wrapped in feather boas together. So it's just fun. And that network was really important. So that was one of the paths I was taking with that event and will when I bring it back is the group, the camaraderie, the bringing people together, the keeping the conversation going when we leave the room. Because that's really where it's at for everybody. It's really so important. We can go, we can sit in the lecture, we can hear the speaker, and then we go back to work and nothing really happens. But if we can stay in that community and keep the conversation going and rely on each other, that's where it all gets done. I mean, I can't remember who, but somebody says that the magic happens in the bar after the conference.
That's true. Very true.
And that is true.
And then when what happens, like we go to these big conferences and there's meeting places in certain hotels and we all gather at those hotels and then they change the hotel and they messed everything up and nobody knows where to go. So we really had some struggles when, especially like VMX, changed the venues for us. And now we're like, where are we supposed to meet all our friends and have these conversations? But, you know, to me, the other cool thing about networking is getting other people's perspective on what's happening in the community. Because, you know, I live like you, I see a lot of these groups on Facebook and I'm listening to a lot of that feedback. And I think, unfortunately, it's a lot of negative feedback. Sometimes I think, ooh, you know, I would really hate to work where you work or work for you. That's the other thing. It's like, whoa. But there's a lot of positive stuff happening out there. And through this networking, we're actually getting to see the cool things that are happening. And know, for me, it's knowing some of the stuff that's coming down the road before anybody else sees it. It's really brand new and shiny stuff, and a privilege to have people reach out to me often and ask for my opinion about things. And, you know, I'm certainly opinionated, so I'm more than happy to do that. But, you know, tell me about thinking about your conference particularly. With that very first one, how did you think about pulling speakers together, or did your sales rep suggest people to you? Is that how, or it was just people that you knew from being active in the Veterinary Managers Association? That first one is so intimidating to me. Like, how did you pull that together?
Yeah, I had done events in the past related to my work with the parrots. So some of that, I already understood the process of what would need to happen, but definitely relied on sales reps a lot. I mean, it kind of came from one asking me about something. And so several of them just, you know, really were excited about the idea and really supported it and helped me build it and bounce around ideas. And finding speakers, of course, I had no budget. There was, so there were some sponsors that were very gracious to believe in the concept. And so there was some money for some speakers. Of course, I spoke at my own event. I didn't even charge myself, so that helped. And charged a small fee to help with the budget as well. But really, I think there are several sales reps that were the reason that it got any wind in its sail. Yeah.
Now I want to talk about another big shift, because you are the hospital administrator for two practices, three practices? How many are, how many, Marshall, do you oversee?
Currently two. That may be going up.
Okay. All right. And then the pandemic hits. Tell me what your kind of thought processes were when everything is shutting down. Of course, we're in South Carolina. So we have to say that in South Carolina, things have been more relaxed than in other areas of the country, but still we were dealing with that. So when you were just, this to me has to be the biggest punt in veterinary history. Right. When things shut down and the pandemic rolls in, how did you plow through that, I guess is my question.
Yeah, I was just as scared as everybody else. And we're looking at, oh my gosh, nobody's gonna be coming in. Revenue's just gonna halt. Selfishly, or, you know, I'm thinking, what does that mean for me? I'm a very expensive person here. If we cut me, that could save somebody else, or, you know, several others, or, you know, what's going to happen. At the time, we also had a boarding kennel business separate from the practices, and of course that crashed. There was really no recovering that one, and so we're looking at the everything with the practice. And so it's like, okay, focus. This is happening. We can respond to it emotionally, or we can respond to it rationally. And that's what the practice owners and I did. We're like, okay, what if this ABC, what if this ABC, we can do this, we could try that. And you just adapt. You don't know how you're adapting, and you come in the next day with new ideas that you've never thought of the day before. And you're like, well, let's try it. What do we got to lose?
Nobody
knows. Let's try that. And you just day by day put it together and make the best of it, and realize that everybody else around you and on your team is scared and uncertain. And so we need to support those people and help them as well, and still appreciate them. You just day by day.
One of the coolest things that I observed, and as an outsider, not having to deal with it every day in practice, was how many people were so generous with their ideas. Everybody in veterinary medicine started to put out, here's what we do, here's how this has helped, here's what worked for us, here's what didn't work for us, into multiple groups, social media groups. And everybody was able to pick up on that and say, "How? Okay, great. We know this is the model for what we can do and how we can manage these things. Or here's a resource for protective equipment or for plexiglass. Or here's a cool idea for the parking lot, how you put the signs in the parking lot that helps clients call in appropriately." There was so much good crowdsourcing of information. I was so proud of our community for being that supportive of each other and generous in what they did, rather than just saying, oh, you know, we're going to keep our secrets to ourselves and try to figure this thing out on our own. And if you think about the California practices, I mean, they were hit the hardest, the earliest, and Washington State, and they figured this out first. And then us over here on the East Coast, we caught it later, but we certainly benefited from their thought processes and their workarounds and failures and successes. So yay for us in veterinary medicine for doing that, because I thought that was just amazingly helpful out there. I'm going to ask you another question about, I think, a equally big challenge in our profession right now, and that is finding employees. Are you struggling to find staff, veterinarians, technicians, assistants, CSRs, everybody, like everybody else in the world?
Absolutely. I don't even know which direction I want to go with that question, because I have a lot of different thoughts about it. Without getting too negative, I will say that I've been around long enough, 23 years, that I think we kind of did this to ourselves. I think the industry kept its head in the sand too long, ignoring the warning signs, and not being willing to adapt when we could have. And here we are. But yes, yeah, staffing is definitely a problem. And I hear it every day from friends and colleagues and clients, and experience it myself. And I know you're hearing it. And there is no quick magic answer. So one thing that I really have come to believe in is you have to hire for your culture, even if that person has no experience, and then you have to build in the time to grow them. So some of the things we're talking about right now is tuition assistance for vet tech school. How do we set that up? So I've been talking to the accountant and the attorney about that, make sure we do it all right, you know, through HR laws and stuff. You offer somebody something, you've got to offer everybody equally in those things. So, you know, is that a program we can create? What's the return on investment with that? And I think it's really significant. What, you know, all the CE events that we've got available to us, especially hopefully as we get back to in-person things and workshops, and just finding the person that fits your mission and your culture and your style, and then help them along from there. I think that's maybe the best option we've got right now. Being in Charleston, it's such a hot market for people moving here that has built a little bit of cushion in for me. I know I worked with one clinic for about a year and a half on consulting assignment. They were offering $150,000 straight salary for a veterinarian 4 days a week, no weekends, no on calls, for a year and a half, and couldn't even get a solid applicant. And they were a great practice. It was just geography. Nobody wanted to move there. I'm afraid it may have been the part of it, but. They worked through it and they found an amazing person. And
well, it's finding the right one. You know, it's just like you said, it's not finding the one that has particularly the skills, but finding the one that has the attitude that fits your culture. And then you can teach the skills. I've always believed you can teach the skills if people are willing to learn. And it is a big challenge right now, especially some of the rural practices are struggling to get people to come out of the cities. I laugh because I was talking to Dan Markwalder, and he owned, I think, about 20 some practices in the Chicago area. And he never had trouble getting veterinarians because people like to move to, you know, there's a lot going on there. But during the pandemic, I went, those rural practices are looking pretty good now, aren't they? Because they were out there in la la land and not exposed to a lot of pressure from the disease, and where those packed communities where people are moving out of there like lemmings to the sea. But, you know, one of the things that you said about growing your own, I've always believed in that. And I spent a lot of time, scheduled time, training my team. And I have a lot of practices who go, well, we don't have time to do all that. And you make time for what you value is my philosophy. So you shut the door and you have meetings and you train people, or you set up a block of time in their day that you send them back for 30 minutes to do some online training, and then you test them and you reward them when they pass those tests. So when I left my last practice, it was a mixed animal practice, and I think we had 4 assistants who were going to tech school, and through the tuition assistance and just kind of signed contracts, loose contracts with them that said we would reimburse them for all of their school and their books, provided they stayed with us 2 years. And it was prorated if they left earlier than that. And it was great. We invested in them because we were out in the middle of the country and we just couldn't find any licensed technicians. I don't know if you saw the survey Bash put up the other day. that VitaSvet ran for them, and that 35% of the veterinarians and the technicians plan to leave the profession within the next 5 years. Now, fortunately, we just opened a new veterinary school, but we won't grow those for another 4 years out. And so we have new vet schools coming on, but we're still having a shortage of technicians. And if we don't figure out how to protect and have our team members thrive, we're constantly going to be churning. And churn is very bad for business because your clients like to see familiar faces. They like to build relationships with people. They like to trust the team that they walk in and see every day. And when you're constantly turning people over, you're always constantly training, and it costs so much to train and so much to weather the mistakes that they make. I think that's a factor that we don't put into the cost of losing people, is that we're not training them and then they're making mistakes and we're losing clients and many other things because of that. But the culture is everything. And you know, you're preaching to the choir when you talk to me about that, because I was writing a column for a year and a half called Culture Coach for Vet Team Brief. But I feel like we need to focus so much more on communication in veterinary medicine and the human part of it, because it's a human business. And the animal business is the product that we sell, but the human part is the business that we are in. And people go into it and say, I love animals, I don't want to deal with people. Well, guess what? Surprise, surprise, that's not how it works. So Marshall, what advice would you give someone who is making a career decision? I mean, we have, like I said, 35% of people are thinking of leaving the profession. What advice would you give those people, whether to stay or whether to go?
I'm a very analytical, investigative type person or personality. So this comes naturally to me, but I would say that to stop and weigh it all out and, you know, look before you leap. Is the grass greener on the other side? What are the problems that you can influence, or what concerns do you have that you can influence them? Honestly, I feel like I see many people just change job, change job, change job, and the problem is always the job. And I'm thinking, well, if we could just stop and talk about a few things and get you to self-reflect a little bit, you might find that you're running from yourself. Mm-hmm. So I think you've got to be aware of that part. Right. Stop, do some training. I've done years and years and years of personal development training and leadership training. And I've been to a couple of those personal development things you see where, you know, people are jumping up and down and carrying on. And those are wild, but you get good things out of all of that. And so that's the first thing you got to do, is stop and identify what the real problem is. When you strip back the feelings, what's the real issue? Can you do something about it, or do we need to make a change? So that's, I think, the biggest part.
I was having a panel discussion last week with Rebecca Rose and Liz Houston and Steven Seidel, and we were talking about how veterinary medicine eats their young. That we let, you know, we have people who are really excited about coming into the profession. We need help. We desperately want people to come into our profession. And then when they come in, we treat them so badly that they don't thrive and they quit. And I understand the storming, norming, and forming, but we've got to do better than that, because otherwise everyone in our profession is going to suffer if we don't change our attitude. And what you said is absolutely pertinent. The only person that you can change is you. You got to fix you first. And if you keep changing jobs and having the same problem in every job, maybe it's you. that is the problem, that is the poor communicator, that is the cause of the drama in the hospital. And people need to realize that you need to take a breath, you know, take a breath and look at yourself. I don't think we're trained to self-reflect very well. Like you said, you've taken leadership, and I have too, and certainly even personality profiling, generational profiling, all these different things that make us tick as human beings are part of learning to be a better person, learning to gain emotional intelligence and self-control. And one of the things that I talk about, and I get some pushback on it, but I want to get your perspective on this. I am not a fan of ranting. To me, ranting is like a 2-year-old temper tantrum that says, I can't control my own emotions. I cannot logically, I'm a logical thinker too, like you said, I cannot logically diagnose the situation. So I'm going to pitch a fit. And what it trains your brain to do is to look for negative things and to not have any self-control of your own emotions. So I would love to hear your perspective on that, because I know you've taken a lot of leadership development stuff and you read as much as I do about this. What are your thoughts about the rants?
Well, your brain naturally wants to be defensive, right? And you naturally want to protect yourself. And so I can understand why we kind of naturally go that way. But yeah, in all the trainings I've done, I've spent a lot of time studying Julie Squires, whom I'm sure many in your audience know for Compassion Fatigue Coach. But this is what she teaches is emotional intelligence and boundaries and self-awareness and controlling your thoughts. And when you do those things, there is really no rant to be had. But it's much easier said than done, isn't it?
It is.
It's still a knee-jerk reaction for me at times to say, and I have to stop myself, self-coach, wait a minute, you know better, here are the tools you know that you have, use those, and I can go another way.
Yeah.
You can come out better. So the rant isn't helpful, is it? If you're going to bring me a problem, bring me a solution is, you know, the thing.
Exactly.
People say. And even if you don't have a solution yet, if you can at least say, I have a problem, I'd like help finding a solution, rather than I have a problem, I'm walking out.
Yeah. I'm going to dump this on you and leave. Yeah. And as managers, This is something I think you and I will both coach managers right here and right now. When your team brings you a problem, do not allow them to dump it on you without asking them what they think will solve it. Because it's very easy to dump a problem on somebody, disappear and bitch about it. But it's much more challenging to think, okay, I've got to engage the smart part of my brain, because I know she's going to ask me, or he's going to ask me, what do you think we ought to do about it?
Okay.
And then sit there, you know, do not be the answer person. And I learned that a long time ago, the hard way, because when I was being treated for breast cancer, I was 46 years old and I was the answer person for my team. And I liked it because, you know, it makes you feel good about your value when you're in the practice. But I did learn when I was out for 6 weeks that they were much more self-sufficient than I thought they were, and that they had been sandbagging me for many years. So as I found out how well they did without me, and I knew that they would, they did a great job. And so when I came back and they started to ask me questions again, I went, never again. I now know that you are perfectly capable of doing this without me. And go forth and do it without me, because you don't need me. And I'll go and use my time for the big picture stuff, for strategic planning, for building that marketing goals and setting that stuff up. So I see so many managers, and I'm sure you see the same thing on those social media feeds, where their staff is constantly asking them questions all hours of the day and night and not giving them any space to have downtime at their home. But I think they fit into that. They have allowed it to happen, and they have not trained their staff to be independent and autonomous. And it's going to come back and bite you on the butt.
It can wear you down. And so you have to learn what those boundaries are and how to put them in place and to allow yourself to turn your phone off and allow yourself to go be your other self and be in the other part of your life. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's hard. Practice managers, there's probably a stereotype there that we're all kind of A-type, controlling, want to do the best. I can just do it myself. Ideas and back away from that a little bit. And then, like you saw with your team, they knew what to do. They figured it out. They might not have done it exactly the way you would have done it, but they got it done. It worked. You just have a little faith,
sometimes a little confidence,
give them a little space. Yeah. It could come out better. You're right. I don't claim to know everything. I just think what I think.
Exactly. And you know, this is one of the things that I talked to to Doug Brooks a little bit about, the diversity and the lack of diversity in veterinary medicine, and the blessing that having people from different perspectives in that hospital and then talking to them and using their life experience to say, hey, how can we make this better? How, from your point of view, because my old white lady point of view is this. So tell me from your point of view, how can we make this better? How can we offer our services to a broader range of people? And that's what I see is going to happen in veterinary medicine, is that we're going to become much more diverse, and we will have a greater pool of possible candidates in the future if we can outreach to young people right now that we say, hey, this is a really great profession. Wouldn't you like to be in veterinary medicine? One of the things that Doug said to me that really struck me is he was talking to one of the multicultural veterinary founders, and she said she was in a school, and she was she's a Black veterinarian, and she was talking to children about becoming a veterinarian, and one little Black child said, I can't be a veterinarian, because she was showing him a book. And she said, why can't you be a veterinarian? She said, because there's no people like me in this book. Veterinarians are not like me. And so she went and wrote a book and had people of all cultures, you know, showing them in veterinary medicine that book. But we are desperately in need of wider perspective, I think, in our profession, and certainly embrace that. Are you seeing improvement in that in day-to-day practice?
Am I seeing improvement in?
In candidates and people wanting to come in your hiring practices and.
Yes. And I think part of that is what you're offering influences who you attract. And that may be, you know, benefits that cost money, but it may be intangible things as well that are about, and that's back to the culture. But it starts with your job ad. Even there's, you know, this has been a topic for years, but job ad of, you know, seeking person that can do this and this and this and this and this, and here's what we'll pay, as opposed to even in your ad starts to show some appreciation and make it feel inclusive and that they're going to be a part of something. So you start there.
Right.
You have to put out there what you want to get back.
Yeah. Yeah. I've told people, I said, look, even in your job descriptions, your ad, who is your ideal person for that? Who is the best person you've ever had doing that job? That's your job description. That's the who you set the bar by, not like the minimum amount of person who might come in and do that. And people want to work in cultures like that. That's something that's very attractive to them. And you're like, I love the job ad reference because it's true. I have seen, they look like equipment lists. I mean, you might as well just say, here's, we have this analyzer, this digital x-ray machine, and this ultrasound. And I think those things are important, but they're not the most important thing. They are not what people are looking for in a job. They're looking for places that they can't wait to get to work rather than can't wait to get off. And you got to build that from the inside out. So Marshall, we're running out of hour here. So I want to ask you, as a kind of a last wind up, any words of wisdom that you have out there in the world that you want to share with people, or and I certainly want you to tell the audience about your company and how to get in touch with you. And we will put that information in the headline of the description. And so they will be able to get in touch with you. Favorite book to share, something, you know, a class that you would recommend, anything like that, that says, this is what you should do. You know, this is the thing.
Yeah. I think it is just to take a deep breath and think it through and determine, is this a problem? Is this something I can deal with? How can I deal with it? What are my options? And try to be rational with it. I have a friend, a vendor rep, that she teaches communication styles, and she puts them on, you know, in the X and Y axis, and she's got the four quadrants, and two are very analytical and two are very emotional. And I'm totally in the analytical part. So maybe this advice is a little biased from the way I approach things, but you got to get out of those feelings and strip it down to the core parts and then figure out what to do with those. Mm-hmm. And it can start to make a lot more sense from there. And then you can present those things to your network and get that help and support. You know, that way. But if you're just giving your network all the drama, what can they really give you back?
Well, they're going to start to avoid you for one thing.
Right. Well, I'm not answering that call.
Oh no, not her. Oh my gosh. Well, do you have a book recommendation? We're trying to kind of create a book recommendation list here. Do you have a favorite thing we can add to our reading list?
Sure, I do. I mentioned my love for Dolly Parton, and my boyfriend gave me her latest book at Christmas, and it's actually propping up the computer. So we'll just move this a little bit. Okay. And what is it? Dolly Parton, Song Teller. It's her story through the decades of where all these songs came from. And it's all of the lyrics, and it's, you know, she's very motivational and inspirational. So it's really cool to read that. Yeah, it's almost like a personal development guide in itself.
She is an amazing human being and incredibly smart businesswoman, but also so altruistic. And I read the other day, and you probably know this stat more than I did, how many children she has reached through the Imagination Library.
And I know.
And the books, I mean, it was like 1.5 million books that she's given away for free over the years, all because her father couldn't read.
Right.
And yeah. just incredible person. And then, of course, she gave $1 million to Vanderbilt for development of the vaccine for COVID-19. And she's made a lot of money, but she puts it back into her community and does good in the world with it. And, you know, I've often said, you know, I just really hope that if I ever was that wealthy, that I wouldn't squander money away on stupid things and do good in the world like she has. So she is definitely a role model for that. Now, we got to see the parrot. So you got to sneak off screen and come back and show off your, at least one of the two parrots.
Yeah, I'm going to go get Midas and we'll be right back.
Midas, okay.
All right, here is my. Right. He's like, "What are you doing? This is not the time of day that you play with me."
Midas,
damn, you're beautiful. Yeah, I'm trying to see on the little screen here if we're getting a good shot of him, but
he's looking straight at me, so I've got a great shot of him.
Well, he is a hyacinth macaw. This is the largest parrot species in the world. He's almost 4 pounds and he has a beak strength of about 2,000 pounds of pressure. He crushes macadamia nuts and everything. And he's just a goofy, little boy. He's
and now
like a puppy.
He's young, right? You got him recently?
He came home at 5 months and he just turned 2 years last week. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he is still young.
He's still young because parents live to be 100 plus, right? So he could be.
Oh, they can. These large species, definitely 70, 80 years, keep them healthy. And of course, he's got pet insurance and
yes,
everything to make sure we do that.
Yes. So my question is, now he's going to outlive you, Marshall. What are you going to do with Midas? Who gets to inherit Midas?
Well, you know, I need to get a will together, but right now it would be my sister would be the unfortunate person to take care of things. But
yeah,
she grew up with us doing the birds, so she knows about them.
She knows about birds too. Well, the reason I ask is my friend Deborah Hamilton does what she calls map plans, and she, you know, people assume that their relatives will take their pets when they pass, or, you know, right. During COVID, you know, a lot of people inherited pets, and you and I both know from the veterinary field that they might inherit them and they'll come in and ask us to find homes for them or want to euthanize them. So having a written plan for what will happen if you're in the hospital or if you're debilitated in some way that somebody's still going to take care of your animals, I think is a good planning thing. And we do talk about parrots and tortoises. You know, these animals live a much longer life than we do. So having an appropriate plan for that. So thank you for sharing him because he's gorgeous. Okay. And I, like I said, I saw him when he first came home. So I've been watching him on Facebook and I knew he was out there and beautiful. I'm very impressed. The only bird I've ever had cover his ears because my mother sat him outside. His name was Wolfpack. He was a parakeet I had when I was at NC State, and I brought him home for Christmas and went back to take an exam. And my mother's a big believer in fresh air, and she put him outside, and it was December. And she said, Deb, when I came home, something happened to Wolfpack. And I went, what do you mean? His little legs were sticking up in the cage like this, and he got too cold outside in the sunshine in December in North Carolina. So,
oh, that's sad.
My mother is no longer taking care of any birds for me. Well, Marshall, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
And thank you. It was fun.
Look forward to seeing the Palmetto Veterinary Conference back on sometime in the future. And if people want to get in touch with you, it is the information is going to be here in the description. Liger Veterinary Consulting out of Charleston, South Carolina. So thank you so much. We're going to go out and enjoy our beautiful South Carolina day because it's about 80 degrees outside and it has been a really long, wet winter.
So, it has, yes. All right. Well, thank you for having me. Congratulations on the success of the Bend.
Oh, thank you so much.